The juvenile justice system has been something that I've been interested in since I've been at the Times Union, and now that I'm on the investigative team, it was something that I wanted to dedicate a little time and looking into. And not soon after I started making rounds and asking some questions, we learned about this issue of direct commitments and how we differ from the rest of the state related to this thing called direct commitments.
And let's explain, what is that? What is direct commitments?
Yes, a direct commitment is when they're usually plea deals that juveniles will reach with the state on anything that they're accused on. They're usually direct commitment is usually, well, they always do not involve DJJ.
The Department of Juvenile Justice.
Department of Juvenile Justice conducts these very detailed evaluations of young people, their treatment needs, what's causing them to act out criminally, and when you have a direct commitment, DJJ does not do that, and they're not permitted or not given the opportunity to make a recommendation to the court or as to what should happen to the young person.
So what are the so in effect, in essence, what is this series finding? What is the major finding?
Well, that when it comes to direct commitments, we dramatically lead the state in this number of direct commitments. And when you talk to the public defender's office and some private attorneys in the community, also at play with direct commitments is that they'll say a significant number of those young people are given the choice between either accepting a commitment to a facility for a period of months or years, or being charged as an adult. And they describe it as a threat, that they're being threatened with adult charges while also being said, well, if you take a deal to be committed, then we won't charge you.
How many juveniles have had this experience, and are these nonviolent offenses or violent ones?
The charges are some of the charges are violent charges. So let's be clear about that. There'll be one young lady that's featured in the story on Sunday who was charged with armed robbery. So there are violent charges among these young people, and we're in numbers. We're talking when we say direct commitments, we're thinking about 1,500 young people. That's what the data from the Department of Juvenile Justice says: 1,500 young people in the last 5 years, and of those, about 800 of them is what the PD will estimate face a threat of adult charges before accepting a plea deal.
And if you're just joining the program, we're speaking right now with Times Union investigative reporter Topher Sanders about Sunday's series in the Florida Times Union, looking at the state of juvenile justice in Jacksonville. We'll go to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. So what is the response, Topher, out of the state attorney's office? State Attorney Angela Corey ran on a platform of reducing crime in Jacksonville, making the streets safer. It is politically popular with much of the public. What is the response from her office to your report?
Well, we're still working with the state attorney's office to see if we can sit down and discuss the issue with her. But in general, having listened to Ms. Corey in public, you know, she describes, you know, what she prioritizes when she looks at these criminal matters. She prioritizes, you know, victims' rights and community safety. And we haven't had a detailed conversation with her, but just listening to her in the public, I would imagine that that those priorities, victim rights and safety in the community, often would play a role in this. Now, the Ms. Corey's office, we haven't spoken to them, but I imagine she probably will not agree with what the public defender's office and some of the private attorneys are saying. She probably will not agree.
And what
with
are and what's the essence of their concern?
That the office is threatening young people with adult charges to compel them into taking these commitment deals. I don't know that the state attorney's office is going to agree with that premise.
Is that something that occurs in other jurisdictions?
It does not appear to occur throughout the state in the way it occurs here.
What's the disparity between the Fourth Circuit and other circuits?
In Miami-Dade, in the last 5 years, there were 34 direct commitments. In the last 5 years in Jacksonville area, there have been 1,500.
Quite a difference. And would Miami, and is the level of juvenile crime in Miami-Dade comparable to Duval?
Juvenile crime, I don't know. I know that they send less young people to incarceration than we do. Significantly less in the last 5 years, half as many.
And if you're just joining the program, what are your questions and comments about the new investigative series looking at concerns about juvenile justice in Jacksonville? 549-2937 to join the discussion. Let's begin down in St. Augustine. Let's start with Jeff this morning. Hello, Jeff. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Melissa. I'm good. You know, I've made this point before, but, you know, it just seems to me that the right wing on this issue has these two diametrically opposed positions. One is this, you know, tough on crime, you know, adult crime, adult time or whatever. And this other one is, you know, no abortion, no birth control services publicly funded. And certainly not that all these criminals or, you know, troubled youth are, you know, children of single mothers. But, you know, I think statistically an awful lot of them are, you know, young, unwed teen mothers. And I think a conservative financial approach would be to incentivize these women somehow not to have children, you know, financially, and also provide them with, you know, as much family planning as we can.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Bill in Clay County is on the line at 549-2937. That's the number to join the show this morning. We want your calls. Let's go with Bill now. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Melissa. How are you doing this morning? Good morning to you. Yes. You know, I work in dependency, and a lot of times we intervene with kids when they come into the system. You know, if kids are coming to the criminal justice system, there's an intervention. I think if you want to start reducing juvenile crime, when a kid comes into the criminal side of the court, you know, there should be some sort of intervention. There should be an evaluation of his home, I believe. There should be an evaluation of his parents, if there's needs, if the family needs. We should start intervening at an early age. And I think this would have an impact on crime. The other issue is that Roosevelt, when he was president, he realized that we had a lot of young people out on the streets that were getting in trouble. And one of the ideas when he created the conservation corps was, let's get these kids involved in programs that are going to help develop them, you know, in terms of education. And then the other issue was it'll help society. That's where we got a lot of our public parks and things of this nature, you know, completed and worked on. But these kids offered their service to the community and the nation, and it gave them a foundation. And I think, you know, as long as in our society, we have this political dynamic that anyone in trouble or anybody that's economically deprived or whatever the case, when they ask for assistance, it's a handout, and society doesn't have a responsibility. But society does have a responsibility, because if you look at the outside cost in terms of incarceration or mental health, if we don't take care of these kids at a young age, we're going to take care of it at the back end of life, and the costs are prohibitive. And that's one of the problems we have in society today.
All right. You know, thank you for the
conservation in its nature. Okay.
Thank you for the call, Bill. When it comes to early intervention for juveniles in Duval County, TOFR, let's discuss what does exist.
Well, you know, there are a lot of diversion programs. Ms. Corey has a diversion program as well. You know, we'll be looking and asking questions about the program and trying to learn as much as we can about the diversion program there. And you know that Mr. Schwarstein has a diversion program that he was very proud of.
The former state attorney.
Yes, ma'am. And so, and, you know, one thing I want to make clear in this is that, you know, trend lines on criminal crime and crime with young people is all going down. And that's in line with all crime statistics across the country. You know, it's all trending down. Arrests are down. The number of young people actually charged as adults is down in statewide and in our own community. But what is up are these direct commitments, these deals being reached where DJJ is not involved and doesn't evaluate the child and make a recommendation to the court. Those are up.
And let's explain what happens over the long term when a juvenile is committed in this way.
What's the
timeline?
Well, they end up spending months, years in a committed facility, and what critics will say is, if through this process of reaching deals where they're faced with an option of adult charges or the deal, you may send some young people to these committed facilities who don't need to be there. The young people who otherwise would benefit more from in community services. You take those young people and put them in communities and these commitment communities with other young people who have real intensive struggles, then you have a person spending a year with that community, and then they come back to your community. And whatever things that rubbed off on them, bad habits, they bring that back to your community when they come back.
You haven't received a response yet from the state attorney's office. Recently, the state attorney made some remarks to the local Tiger Bay Club, very critical of the Florida Times Union, saying that she believes that the newspaper of record in this community has an agenda to go after her in lieu of other words. What's your response to the hostility and that it is not a good relationship?
I think it's unfortunate. And I'll say to you just my own personal experience. Ms. Corey has been nothing but respectful and courteous when I've interacted with her. She's never given me any kind of hostile energy. I will say that for whatever reason, the relationship between her office and the newspaper is not the same relationship we have with other agencies. And I think the community has benefited when the state attorney and the newspaper of record do have a line of communication and can communicate openly. I think the community benefits. So that's what I feel about.
And it's 549-2937 to join the show this morning. Let's go downtown to Eric. Hello, Eric. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Hi, Topher.
Hi.
I just wanted to say is that I think that Topher hit upon it in the sense is that when you put kids who have minor problems with kids who have larger problems, the kids who have the lesser problem that were put into the system often ends up coming out in worse shape than they entered. And that ends up to being a recidivism going on. I think it's well over 50% kids that enter the system end up going on and committing other crimes or getting involved in crime. And I try to look at it in an economic sense, and that is that these people, when they get out of this process and they go back in the community, are more likely to be involved in crime, and they get felonies, they can't get jobs, and then ultimately when they can't get jobs, they contribute less to the taxes of the community, and ultimately the community pays for the mistake of putting them into the bad system in the first place, and we don't have full participants in our society. And if we're going to be competing against places like China and other places, we need every single person in this community to be a full participant. And this system makes sure that that doesn't happen.
Eric, thanks for calling in. Tweets coming in. It's time for restorative justice in our schools and our courts, or also known as smart justice. What about that movement? And do you see that coming to this circuit?
Well, there are efforts afoot. I mean, the mayor announced an effort a couple of weeks ago or a week or so ago that there's going to be pouring some resources into neighborhood accountability councils and to the teen court. So there are some efforts. There are early intervention programs, like you mentioned, like the civil citation program, taking young people who are first time misdemeanors and giving them alternatives to arrest so that they don't get introduced to the system in that way, but still making them face some consequences. So those things are happening. They're happening to a lesser degree in our community than they are in other places, but they're happening.
And there's pressure on the state attorney's office to increase the number of civil citations by a number of local lawmakers, community activists. Where's that conversation?
I think it's still an ongoing conversation. I don't know that they've reached an end point on what's going to happen with that. I think that there are some conversations happening to see if they can increase that, but I don't know if they got a resolution yet.
And if you're just joining us, what are your questions and comments as we preview the Times Union's investigative series debuting this Sunday, looking at issues related to juvenile justice in Jacksonville? 549-2937 to join the conversation. Nick in St. Augustine. Hello, Nick. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I used to manage a group home in North Carolina for adjudicated youth, and I'm curious how much of the facilities that these kids are getting directly committed to are privatized, and what kind of money might be involved in that and how that affects the system.
That's going to be one of the points of our examination in the next following months. But I can tell you that 100% of them are privatized. And
The issue of prison privatization across the state is controversial, not just here in this part of the state. Critics say if there's a profit motive behind prisons, you always need new product, new inmates. Others say, well, it's just more efficient. It saves the state money to privatize.
Yeah, it's something that we have to dig into and that we will be digging into. But to answer your question, 100% of those facilities are privatized. And then on the subject of money, I will say that, you know, it's when they look at the continuum of things they can do to a young person who has a is accused of a crime, it's 12 times more expensive to put a young person in one of these facilities than it is to put them on probation. Now, I've heard Ms. Corey speak, and what Ms. Corey will say is you can't end your cost analysis there. There's costs also born when young people who you're giving this leniency to recommit.
If they reoffend,
there's a cost there. So that's what the state attorney would say that.
549-2937. Let's go to David calling from up at JIA. Hi, David, up by the airport.
Good morning, Melissa. I just wanted to commend you for your coverage of this and Topher for his coverage of this and point out that Ms. Corey is really, really wrong on this issue on a number of levels. You know, first of all, the research is clear, as many of your callers have said, that not only, you know, do we have an inkling that putting low-risk kids into these facilities actually creates more crime. It's been proven. There's 50 years of research on that. So it's very, very likely that what Ms. Corey is doing is actually increasing crime, decreasing public safety. The other thing I will say, I've been working on juvenile justice reform for years, and the most important thing for this system is light and transparency, because, you know, so often the system uses the shield of confidentiality to allow abuse to go on in facilities, as we're finding now from the Huffington Post, to find, you know, direct commitments that Mr. Sanders' great work has shown, to find that a lot of the so-called diversion programs supported by the service state attorney aren't really diversion at all, because they require the child to be arrested. So, you know, transparency is the most important thing right now in Jacksonville, and kudos to you and Mr. Sanders on that.
Thanks for the call. Topher, the New York Times recently spotlighted Jacksonville on this issue. They published a story about a teen in Jacksonville who tried to commit an armed robbery, tried to shoot an adult, didn't injure the man, but was sentenced to 70 years without parole, a 14-year-old boy. And that put the national spotlight on the way this circuit treats juveniles, that case cited by some as an especially dramatic example. Now, yeah. That's a little separate from your story on direct commitments. This was a juvenile sentenced as an adult.
That's right. Yeah, no, it's a national conversation that the entire country's having. And just as recently as 2012, you have states like Colorado really evaluating how they want to deal with the prosecutor's power to charge a young person as an adult, and putting some mechanisms, some checks and balances in place there. And it's what critics here in our community say needs to happen in the state of Florida to put some checks and balances, allow judges to maybe review some of these decisions so that that they feel that there's some more equity in the system.
Pat in Fleming Islands with us now. Hello, Pat. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. I've got just a couple of questions. And I know some of these kids are really, in fact, bad apples, and we really need to identify them and put them away. However, what do we still have any of the boot camps or any of the Scared Straight programs? Did they work? Are they still out there? Are they too expensive? I just wonder if your guest knows about them.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Pat.
Yeah, I don't know details. I know there are some still around in the state. There's a lot of study out there, most of it saying that those boot camp in particular type of programs are not effective. That
they've largely been discredited.
Yeah,
right?
They have.
Grace emails us on Facebook. When Angela Corey ran for office, she promised to put more juveniles in jail, and people voted for her, making the case that a large segment of the electorate in this circuit likes this approach and does not have a problem with it.
That's correct. Yes, ma'am. Ms. Corey has a huge block of support, and she was very honest and transparent with the voters with how she was going to run the office, and I think that's definitely what's happening.
Let's go to Wayne in Jacksonville. Hey, Wayne, thanks for your call. You're on the air, Wayne.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Go ahead.
Well, I'll just like that. They're pretty much schools have a zero tolerance for anything now. My kids, after Halloween this year, the school had pumpkins for decorations they used, and after Halloween, they put them out by the dumpsters to throw away. And my kids went up there and kind of smashed them up and did what kids kind of do sometimes. And they were suspended for 2 weeks.
Right.
You know, and I mean, I thought that was extremely harsh. I mean, years ago, they, you know, would have made you clean up the mess and maybe put you on after school suspension. But I mean, they actually, you know, sent them to the bad boy school for 2 weeks. And I mean, they threatened to suspend them permanently.
I thought
that was extremely extreme, you know, for such a, you know, such a minor incident.
Wayne, thanks for sharing that. Interesting perspectives on the phone lines. Jim on the south side. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Fine. How are you today?
Great.
I want to ask Mr. Sanders, what does he believe that if the failure of Duval County Public Schools in exceptional student education, ESE, has enhanced, or not enhanced, but made the juvenile justice system even worse because these children are not given the services and the education they need for their disabilities. You know, I heard the superintendent speaking the other day on a dyslexic conversation on NPR, matter of fact, saying that 15% of the children have dyslexia. And we're starting this program, R.L. Brown, that's going to be able to cure it for, not cure it, but be able to teach these kids strategies for 250 children. But what about the other 15 to 20,000 children who have dyslexia, according to his numbers?
Mm-hmm.
Do they just get caught in the, they just get, you know, blown off where they don't get education they're mandated by law to give these students?
Yeah, thanks for the call. Thanks, Jim, for that.
Okay.
And let's talk about the school district's piece of this.
It's a good question. You know, the first part of my examination of this issue isn't looking into the school system. There may be some good research out there connecting, special education and exceptional education to criminal justice and juvenile justice, and that's probably worth a look. I haven't looked at that.
Jim emails the show, the state attorney did not face the voters in 2012. No candidate ran against her. Her popularity may be overblown at this time. No word that I have heard yet about her next race having an opponent.
Yeah, I have not heard anything about the political landscape related to the state attorney's office.
But meanwhile, your piece runs Sunday and the first in a series?
It's definitely ongoing work. We're going to be looking at this for the next following months, and we're really interested in the subject matter, and it's not just going to be myself. There are a number of reporters who will be working on this issue. And I should also note that the piece runs Sunday. Our news partners, First Coast News, will have an in-depth interview with Monica and her mother, with them describing their experience with direct commitment. Monica Jones is one of the young people that we're talking about that will be in our story. And then on Tuesday, there will be another story looking at the history of the power to charge a juvenile as an adult.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.